something more of a conversation rather than you just being talked about. So please welcome our first speaker, Alex Snowden, and thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Craig. And although this is a short notice, I'm going to really make an effort to address the current issues, the current priorities for us. I want to start by saying a little bit, as Craig noted, about remembrance and about the centenary of the end of World War One, and then move on to talking about current foreign policy issues. But I'll just start by saying there's a publication that we have in stock, the war that's on sale at the back, where it covers several big topics in the world today that are of concern to us as a campaigning organisation. If you look through the contents, there's a chapter on Syria, there's one on Yemen, there's one on Iraq, there's one on Afghanistan, there's one on the role of NATO, there's one on the arms trade. There could be other things, Palestine and Israel, for example. And that point about the proliferation of wars, particularly since 2001, is, I think, incredibly important. Occasionally, when doing stalls and campaigning activities, someone will say, oh, stop the war, which war? What war's going on? Well, it is a case of, you know, take your pick. There's several examples of either current military operations, of occupations, ongoing military occupations, or we're living with the immediate aftermath of invasions, bombing campaigns, and occupations. And just last week, there was a new report of a new survey and major piece of research which has been investigating the human losses as a result of the so-called War on Terror since September 2001, particularly looking at Iraq and Afghanistan. And its estimate was the number of people who died as a direct result of those wars since 2001 is around the 500,000 mark. It's 500,000 people. And that is massive. It's not on the scale of World War One, thankfully, not on the scale of World War Two, but this is the reality of our world today. And it does make a mockery of the notion that we would have a world without war after 1918, the war to end all wars, or even after World War Two and the birth of the United Nations and so on. The idea that we would bring an end to war. Or even, let's fast forward 45 years, look at the end of the Cold War. Francis Fukuyama famously prophesied the end of history, talked about there are no great major conflicts and dividing lines in the world anymore. It's a kind of triumph of liberal democracy. That has turned to rubble in so many ways. The crisis of neoliberalism in sort of an economic and social field that we've seen, but also in terms of foreign policy, in terms of geopolitics, we've seen recurring conflicts over the last nearly 30 years since the end of the Cold War. And in fact, this kind of unipolar world where the US is dominant and is the only superpower remaining has turned out to be a remarkably dangerous world. And I think with Trump as president, becoming in many ways even more dangerous. In terms of the centenary of World War One, I do think this is profoundly political. And even when it's talked about as if it's not political, that is in itself an ideological and political move. There are a number of key questions we need to ask about how remembrance is done and how the centenary of the end of the war is marked. I mean, one question to ask is, are we simply mourning the British and Commonwealth soldiers who were killed? Or are we mourning, commemorating all of those who were killed in the war? That is itself a political choice. The way in which remembrance has been done officially, and the way in which the centenary of World War One has been conducted, sort of mainstream politics, mainstream media, and so on, is very much that one-sided emphasis on purely and only commemorating the British and Commonwealth dead. Is it these soldiers, or do we recognise civilian deaths too? Now it is the case that a very high proportion of those who are killed in wars and conflicts are civilians. And that has increasingly been the case since, really, after 1945. Do we recognise that, or do we treat war as if it's simply about soldiers fighting on two sides? Do we recognise the complexity of the way war is today? Most importantly of all, I think, is this question of, do we regard it as some sort of worthy sacrifice? The way in which it's now very much talked about in terms of heroes, these were heroes, as if they died for a worthy cause, a just cause. It was somehow worthwhile. It was terrible, but this was necessary, this was a justified war? Or do we see it as a terrible and futile waste and a crime and an outrage that millions of people were killed? And finally, what are the lessons for today? That's one of the big questions to ask. And I think if you look at the official approach, the way in which things are conducted at the Cenotaph on Sunday, all of the sort of TV coverage of the sort of big remembrance services and so on, it is very depoliticised. It's very much one-sided. It's very partial in its in the picture that it presents. And there has been, I think, not just around remembrance, but concerted efforts since 2014, when the centenary of the war began. There has been a concerted effort to actually reframe the way in which World War I is discussed, away from a view that had been largely established by people for a long time, which is that it was a terrible waste of human life, that it was unjustified and something to be regretted, towards framing it as, there's one documentary I've seen, a TV documentary about the war as part of the centenary, which was actually called A Necessary War, and the argument of it was that it was in fact necessary to Britain to respond to this terrible German aggression and stand up for lucky little Belgium and all the rest of it. Some of these kind of old myths that were used at the time to justify the war being resurrected, and I think we do need to dismantle that. So I do think that the whole question of the centenary is relevant, and it's political, and it's highly, highly contested. And the biggest job that we have when it comes to that is contextualising it, not simply sanitising it and decontextualising and depoliticising it, but actually talking about the real history. So that means, and I'm not going to try and answer these questions now because I'm mainly talking about current foreign policy, but key questions that I would ask, one would be, why did the war actually happen? That gets you into talking about the conflict between rival imperialist states that had built empires that were greedy for land, for power, for resources, and actually looking at the roots of that conflict. Secondly, it means, why did it go on so long and kill so many people? The scale of death in World War I was unimaginable to earlier generations. It was on a massively different scale to any previous wars. And that means looking at the industrialised nature of that warfare, the way in which industry developed and technology developed to a point where mass slaughter was possible and did indeed happen. And finally, why did it end? How did it come to an end? Now, there's been no discussion about this in the media at all. None of the politicians really talk about this. The fact that actually rebellions and mutinies and dissent in the ranks was crucial to bringing the war to an end. First of all, in Russia in 1917, and then in the German Navy in particular in 1918. The role of mutinies and rebellion in forcing an end to the war is something that is not discussed at all. And so we need to particularly be using the end of the centenary of the end of the war to actually be talking about that and bringing that history back. So I think there is a link, there's a number of links between the past and the present, there's a number of links between World War I and what's going on today. And I think one of them is recognising that this effort over the last few years to push back against the kind of accepted view of World War I and to actually try and rehabilitate the reputation of the politicians and generals who took us into that war and who conducted that war, that is motivated by current political concerns. There has been a growth in anti-war public opinion since 2001, particularly in relation to the war in Iraq, which generated the most enormous opposition. I was on many of those demonstrations, including the huge February 15th, 2003 demonstration, I'm sure some people here were. And that was, you know, those demonstrations really represented a groundswell of opinion against the war in Iraq, but also backlash against war and against British foreign policy, in a sense that things need to change, a sense that we can't go on resorting to military means to resolve every situation. And I think that, you know, people like David Cameron, when he was Prime Minister, and he launched in 2014 this big, you know, we're gonna make a big deal of the centenary. It's going to be like the 2012 London Olympics, he said. We're going to have this kind of huge... And actually, it hasn't come to very much, to be honest. They haven't been able to go down that road as much as they like. People like Cameron and Michael Gove, when he was Education Secretary, made a big deal about teaching. It's got to be taught in schools in a way that recognises that there was a strong case for the war and actually get rid of this, what they call the Blackadder view of the war, the sort of Blackadder goes forth view, which is absolutely kind of visceral about how terrible it was. And, you know, get beyond the ways in which the famous poets like Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon, the great war poets, represented it, the Oh, What a Lovely War kind of version of it. We've got to roll back against this and actually put across a different vision. I think that comes from anxiety and fear about the anti-war backlash that we've seen in recent years. The fact that it's become harder for them to go to war. We saw that a few years ago when Cameron's administration, when they failed to get through a vote in the House of Commons for an attack on Syria. That was really that anti-war sentiment building up, and I think it's become much harder for them. So, I mean, that leads on to the question of current foreign policy. And one of the... I think the context for this is really everything that's happened since 2001. And we're talking about the proliferation of wars and all of the different countries that you can talk about now. When Stop the War was launched in September 2001, and of course it was Stop the War because at that time there was only a threat of one particular war, at least that was on immediately on the horizon, and that was Afghanistan. We did nonetheless recognise that the people in George Bush's administration, sort of neocons, neoconservatives, were taking a longer term view. They did have a strategy. They had a sense that they could use the horrific terrorist outrage of September the 11th as a basis, as a pretext for pushing some of the things that they've been talking about for years already. And Iraq was particularly critical in that. I think Iran was also part of that picture, and they were never able to pursue that. But they had a kind of set of wider objectives in the region, in the Middle East. And what was really central about British foreign policy at this time under Blair, and I think we've seen this since, is a complete subordination to what Washington wants. So London has been tied to Washington. British foreign policy has really been subordinate to America. But I do think we also need to recognise that goes back a lot further. You can trace that right back to the end of the Second World War. There are very, very few examples since then of British governments dissenting from what the US is doing and dissenting from the Washington line. Very few examples. And to be honest, that's even true of the main party in opposition. So even when it's been the Tories in government and Labour in opposition, this is well before Blair, there are sadly not many examples of even Labour oppositions dissenting from the dominant view, or on any other foreign policy issues, whether it's been the US that's been pushing things or not, there's been a bipartisan approach between Tories and Labour. There's often been tremendous grassroots dissent in the Labour Party and in the wider Labour movement, but in terms of the official policy, it has been fairly bleak. Go back to the best of the Labour governments, which was Attlee's government after 1945. That was still fairly awful in terms of foreign policy. The establishment of NATO and Britain as an absolutely central part of NATO. America has always dominated NATO, and it's really about American power, and it's about locking a whole range of other countries into alliances with the US, subordinate alliances to the US, really. Also, the beginning in secret, even in secret from Attlee's own cabinet, in fact, the beginning of developing a nuclear weapons programme, which has never been an independent nuclear deterrent, and it still isn't today, because it depends, and always has depended at every level, on the US. It depends on their military expertise, the technological know-how, the resources, and so on. It has never been a genuinely independent deterrent. So you go back to that period, and you already have at that time of decolonisation of British imperial decline, you have Britain kind of attaching itself to the then dominant superpower. And then, of course, in more recent memory, in more recent history, we see the sort of Bush-Blair relationship where, you know, Bush could absolutely do no wrong. Tony Blair was willing to lie to Parliament, to get into the most extraordinary contortions to try and justify the invasion of Iraq, despite massive domestic opposition. And as I say, there's a kind of history of bipartisan support across the Tories and Labour as well. And even, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is often scaremongering about Jeremy Corbyn by comparing him to Michael Foot. And I mean, it's worth recalling that Labour, when led by Michael Foot, did fully support the Falklands War. And then when led by Kinnock, fully supported the Gulf War in 1990-91. And so there is a fairly rotten history of British political support for the US and for military adventures of its own. the context we're in now with foreign policy is I think we're dealing with the failures of the war on terror. We are dealing with the fallout and the failures from that whole period. As I say, about 500,000 people killed. Deeply unstable countries. There's a report just the other day about Afghanistan where someone was quoted, an Afghan was quoted as saying, they promised us a paradise and it's turned into hell. That is a very common Afghan view of the reality there. The US is estimated to have spent $900 billion since 2001 on Afghanistan. A lot of it on direct military operations. Just pause for a moment to think about what that could do, $900 billion actually spent in a constructive way, whether at home in America on things like healthcare or internationally in terms of overseas aid and development. And it is absolutely appalling. But a lot of it on infrastructure, building infrastructure that they had effectively destroyed or they'd had a role in destroying in the first place. The situation in Yemen is horrific. In one day, 24-hour period, just the other day, 149 people were killed in a single assault in Yemen. Save the Children currently are estimating, just in a new report that came out a few days ago, currently estimating that the number of children in Yemen who will have died from starvation during 2018 will be around 36,000. And Yemen is a war being waged by Saudi Arabia, which is an absolutely critical ally for the US and is loyally supported by Britain too. And our big campaigning priority at the minute to stop the war is to break the arms trade with Saudi, to demand an immediate end to selling arms and doing business with the Saudi regime. This should have happened years ago. It is now absolutely clear how disastrous that complicity has been, because that plays a role in the horrors that we are seeing. They are talking about the worst humanitarian, one being on the brink of the worst humanitarian catastrophe on the planet. The final bit of the context that we're in is, I think, we're now 2 years into the Trump administration. And when he became president, there was this idea that he was an isolationist. He was kind of going to retreat from this period of war and military adventurism. Actually, it's turned out to be very different. He's ripped up the deal with Iran and reimposed sanctions. There's been threats to North Korea, which created that sense of, you know, the kind of nuclear war fears of the 1960s might be coming back. The most extraordinary, uncritical support for everything that Israel does, however appalling. And building international alliances with the most right-wing regimes that there are, from Hungary to Israel to Poland. That makes things worse. And what's particularly outrageous in this country is that Theresa May was the first foreign leader to go and actually visit Trump when he became president and held hands with him, and then invited him over here. Huge pressure meant that the state visit didn't go ahead, which we should be very proud of. There's a big, big campaign around that. But still we see this kind of slavish subservience to Washington and the most dangerous American regime we've seen. So that's the context that we're in. The alternatives follow on automatically from a lot of that, I think. If you outline what we're against, if you outline what the problems are, the solutions actually become quite obvious. You know, people sometimes say, well, what would you do instead? You know, like when invaded Iraq, the people say, well, what would you do instead? Well, the first thing is that you don't make things worse. You know, if there's a house burning down, you don't set fire to all the other houses in the same street. Don't make things worse. In Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and Yemen and Syria, it's made things worse. Western intervention has made things worse. When you take the military out of the equation, you take invasions and occupations and bombing campaigns out of the equation, you can start looking at, I mean, however terrible the circumstances might be in a country, how you can actually start providing useful support, practical support, economic aid and so on, to actually make things better. But the crucial thing is stop making things worse. Stop selling them arms. Stop selling Saudis arms. Stop selling Israel arms. Stop invading countries. Stop bombing countries. This is the crucial thing. So the key things I would say, just to kind of quick checklist to finish with. There are things that I think Labour, with Corbyn, Corbyn has an extraordinary track record. He used to be chair of Stop the War. He spoke at the big demonstrations and the public meetings. I remember him coming up to Newcastle to speak here. In fact, he spoke at Newcastle University in 2009. He has an amazing track record, which is not matched by a lot of the people around him on the front bench. There are things that Labour has absolutely got right, and they're a lot better than what we've got from the government at the moment. Saying no more of the military interventions. We need to stop the arms trade with Saudi Arabia, and so on. There are things where I think we need to go further. One of those is around Trident. I'm just going to raise that at the moment for discussion later. But we do not need to be spending £200 billion on renewing nuclear weapons, which we'll never use. And if we do use them, it's even worse than if we don't use them. It's immoral, it's completely irrational, and it's highly, highly dangerous. We need to get out of NATO. That's one of the things we need to be pushing for. NATO locks us into this subordination to Washington. We need to get out. And another key thing is to reduce arms spending. There's, you know, at the moment, unfortunately, Labour, like the Tories, is pledging sort of 2% of GDP on arms. That's ridiculous. We should be cutting spending on arms. We've spent an enormous amount on wars and occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan. That needs to change. Not just scrapping Trident and saving money and investing that in public services, NHS, education, but actually cutting the military budget and having a different set of priorities where we focus that money on public services, on people's needs here, and also on positive international aid to those who need it elsewhere in the world. And I'll stop there. Thank you, Craig.
Well, thanks very much, Alex. Lots to think about there. And without further ado, we're saving the questions for Alex until after Nick has spoken.